Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugrupul people, Yugambe, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Nunakal, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you, and welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, another great day. Blue sky and sunshine. And let's hope it's a good day for you. It'll be as good as you make it. Don't let anyone put the clouds in your sunshine. My guest today, talking to me from Melbourne, Mr. Gary Foley. Black Doctor. Gary Foley. Also a columnist with Tracker magazine. Welcome to the program, Gary. How are you?
Morning, Tiger. Morning, everybody, everywhere. Beautiful day here in Melbourne, as always.
Of course. It's a beautiful day, whatever the weather is, mate. It's still a beautiful day.
Right.
At our age, to be able to wake up and greet the day, it's got to be good. Tell
Just
me.
To be able to wake up every day is a good bar. Yes.
That's right. It's a bonus. It's a bonus. Gary, tell us your mob, your country.
Goombanja, Nambagaids, North Coast, New South Wales. But I've lived in Melbourne for 42 years now, which is a long time, folks.
So it is a long time, by gee, yeah.
So I've been an interloper on Wurundjeri country for some considerable time now, but they've been very tolerant hosts.
Yes, no, it is a beautiful...
very good to me.
It's a beautiful city. I prefer Melbourne to Sydney. Sydney's just, I don't know, after all my time in Sydney, and then you visit mm-hmm. Melbourne, and I think Melbourne is a livable city. It's a good place. Gary, where did you grow up and schooling and stuff like that?
I spent 10 years of my childhood in Tenterfield, in Peter Allen territory.
Tenterfield, places, yeah.
But I left there when I was about 12 and moved into my father's country and lived with my grandmother in Nambucca Heads. And I got expelled in a notorious incident at Maxwell High School in 1960, end of 65, I think it was, 66. And I moved to Redfern. Spent a lot of time in Redfern until about 72. And then I moved to Melbourne, ostensibly to work with my mentor and role model, Bruce McGuinness, the late Bruce McGuinness.
When did you become involved or interested in politics and realise that there's things need to be done, things just aren't right for our mob?
When I got a good kicking from the New South Wales Constabulary, I often tell my students that what put the fire in my belly and what really got me fired up when I was 17, I got a good kicking from a bunch of corrupt thugs from the New South Wales Police Force. And as I say to my students, you know, I'm not exaggerating when I call them corrupt thugs, because that was the nature of the New South Wales Police Force at the time. And as these days a historian, I can say to you that it's an established part of the historical record that the government of New South Wales at the time in the mid-1960s in New South Wales, the Askin government, was one of the most corrupt governments in the history of New South Wales, which is really saying something when you look at the history of corruption in New South Wales. So a bunch of corrupt copper thugs, a bunch of racist corrupt copper thugs instilled in me an anger which pretty much persists to this day. The other thing, I suppose, and I think I've talked about this before, that politicised me was when Paul Coe, who I'd just met not long after I'd got a kicking from the coppers, Paul Coe gave me a copy of the autobiography of Malcolm X. And upon reading that book, it gave me a broader perspective of what was going on in the world and gave me a basis for a lot of the political thought that persists within me to this day. So, I mean, the New South Wales coppers almost turned me into a racist. Malcolm X, ironically, turned me away from racism, taught me not to be a racist, which is one of the really important early lessons that I learned. And luckily, I learned it very early because, I just don't believe that that we need to become like them in order to get around them. We're smarter than that. And we're better than that.
Yes, no, we certainly are smarter than that and better than that. We don't need to be like them. Now, your further studies, you completed a PhD, is now Dr. Gary Foley, you're a historian, you lecture at university. When did you decide then to pursue the education to this extent?
Well, it's a funny thing, you know, because for the greater part of my life, I was one of these silly buggers who argued that, you go to university, you get too uppity and you get alienated from your people and you become a wanker. But then late in life, when I was in my late 40s, I started to read some of the nonsensical interpretations of history that I had been part of and that you'd been involved in too. Things like the Aboriginal Embassy and historical sort of aspects of the land rights movement in the late 60s, early 70s was starting to be written about for the first time by non-Aboriginal Australian historians. And it really irked me that the perspective that they were placing and having been there, I knew that what they were writing in many instances was wrong. And so it was partly that, and partly the fact that in a discussion I once had with the head of the history department at the University of Melbourne, she insulted me to the extent of suggesting to me that they couldn't help me in this little project I was trying to do in terms of archival stuff because I didn't have any formal academic qualifications. And so that became a challenge for me because I said to this head of the history department, I said, look, I'll come and get you a Mickey Mouse little bit of paper if that's all you want, you know. I said, well, it mustn't be too difficult. You've got one. And sure enough, it wasn't too difficult. I mean, you know. And so I ended up as an undergraduate student at the University of Melbourne at the age of about 48 or something. And almost immediately, it's an interesting thing when a black fella, an older black fella, a black fella who, among a lot of other people, was part of making history in the late 60s and early 70s. It's an interesting thing when someone like me lands in a history department at a university like Melbourne because all of these resident non-Aboriginal historians, Australian historians, suddenly feel very threatened. You know, for no logical, rational reason. all I can put it down to is that they're threatened by the authenticity of the of the subject who's about to write back. And so these academic historians started spreading stories around the University of Melbourne. Oh, Foley's only here to shit stir, he won't last long. And this come back to me. You know, I've got eyes and ears everywhere. I've been around a long time. And word of this got back to me. And so I said to myself, well, I'll show these bastards. And so I put my head down and my ass up, and I became one of the star students in my class. I was competing against young, smart kids, you know, kids who'd had a privileged upbringing, kids who'd gone to the best schools in Australia, but they were still kids. I mean, the only thing that evened the advantage was that I had life experience. That was the only thing I had over them. And I became a star student. And then the next thing, the historians or people in the history department started saying, oh, Foley's only doing good because he's got a specialist area of specialist expertise. And so word of this got back to me. And I said to myself, OK, I'll show you bastard. And so I went and studied German history of the first part of the 20th century. I wrote an essay called Australia and the Holocaust, which created history because it led to the discovery that the first group of people in the Australian community in 1938, after Kristallnacht, after the big pogrom of the Jews in Germany in November 1938, the first voice, in fact the only voice, that was raised in the Australian community in protest about that was a group of Aboriginal people from Melbourne, from the Australian Aborigines League, Danny Nichols, William Cooper, Bill Owners, Marge Tucker. And, you know, this was completely unknown in history. And, you know, that's now acknowledged. That act is now acknowledged by a big plaque on the wall of the Holocaust Museum in Elsternwick in Melbourne. You know, there was a big ceremony there. So I jarred these people at Melbourne Uni. Then I got through with first-class honours in history at their flash university, you know. And so they were forced to start taking notice of me. And now that I've got a doctorate, you know, they've got to take notice of me. I've shown that in many instances, I'm at least as good as, if not better, than most of the contemporary crop of Australian historians who are writing about the stuff that I do. So anyway, there you go.
It's certainly an inspirational story. I mean, it's just fantastic. What an achievement. At that stage in life, you know, you're 40 plus, looking at 50, and you embark on that.
There's also a lesson in there for other people my age when I go to uni. I mean, it is possible. I mean, the thing that we do have that evens the advantage a bit is the fact that we have life experience. You know, we've got a lot of experience under our belt, and that sort of evens the odds when we're competing against young smart kids. But one of the things that was offered to me at Melbourne Uni, the bureaucrats and that were, when they realised I was doing all right, they started saying to me things like, "Oh, Foley, you know, you can get credit for life experience. You don't have to do all of the essays, or you don't have to do all of this work." And I said, "Well, no, I don't want any, special consideration." I said to them, "I'm here to prove something to myself. And when I walk out of this place with a little bit of paper that they told me I ought to get, then I will know that I earned that." You know, I didn't go for any shortcuts. Everything that's in that PhD that sits on my wall, I earned. And I earned it the hard way. I did the hard yards, and I deserve it. And that's a good feeling too. And I'd encourage people not to cop their bullshit life experience stuff. It is possible to do the work, and you get a much better feeling of self-satisfaction when you do the work. And you know then that you're whatever qualification you've got, you've earned every inch of the way.
So you're now on the payroll of the university as a historian.
Not Melbourne,
and lecturer.
Uni, Melbourne, interestingly. No, I work at Victoria University in the Western Suburbs of Sydney. I worked at Melbourne Uni for 6 or 7 years, but I find the situation in the Western Suburbs and Melbourne to be a much more interesting place. You know, there's much more needy students there. There's a lot of couriers, a lot of refugees, asylum seekers, and a lot of working class poor white people.
Right.
And I just find that the sort of student body there are a far more interesting bunch of people than all the rich kids and the privileged ones at the University of Melbourne, who, you know, which is what most of them are at Melbourne, you know. And it's a lot of the refugees and people who are just gotten out here, when they're in my class learning about Australian history and the experience of Aboriginal people, they're able to relate in their essays how they feel, because they've, in many instances, had experience of dispossession, dispersal, all sorts of horror stories themselves. And I encourage them that, I encourage the students, especially have arrived here in those sort of circumstances, to incorporate their stories into the essays they write. And I get amazing stuff, you know. I love my students. They're just such an extraordinary bunch sometimes, and really moving and extraordinary stories of survival from people who've, you know, been through all sorts of shit and then get treated like shit when they get here and, you know, called filthy names like asylum seekers. Go home, you know.
Yeah. Gary, yesterday, the Australian National University's Nicholas Biddle, whoever Nicholas may be, wrote a report, and it was released yesterday. But it's another one of these reports that tell us what we've known for the last 40 years and maybe longer. That Aboriginal, and the first line of this press release says, Aboriginals do not come close to socioeconomic equity with other Australians anywhere in the country. A groundbreaking report reveals. I haven't got the report. I don't know that I'm interested in the report because, like I said, it's telling us nothing new. So it's telling us stuff that we know and have been driving for a long, long time for improvement. When you, in mentioning that $20 or $25 billion being spent, what are the problems? Where do we go? How do we make changes? And with the likes of the new government, their advisory committee, what are your thoughts on this whole scenario?
Well, we need to go back to one of the great authorities in Australian politics, a woman from up your way, red hair, a woman called Pauline Hanson. Pauline Hanson got it half right, 25 years ago, when she said, there's an Aboriginal industry. Everybody jumped all over her head and accused her of being a racist. And the only way she was a racist was in that she made the mistake then of saying, there is an Aboriginal embassy, Aboriginal industry. Look at all this money being spent. And that was fine, except then she took a leap of faith and said, all this money's going to the Abbeys. You know, the Abbeys are getting all this money, so therefore it's an Aboriginal industry. Well, she was half right. There is an Aboriginal industry. There was then. There is now. The Aboriginal embassy...
you got embassy on the brain.
Industry, yeah. The Aboriginal industry is comprised of an army. You know, probably more white bureaucrats than there are Aborigines. You know, white parasites, missionaries, mercenaries and misfits who consume the vast amount of money that the Commonwealth's been chucking at the so-called problem for the last, well, since Gough Whitlam. 1972, Gough Whitlam became the first federal government that started pouring Commonwealth government money into Aboriginal affairs. The first budget in 1973 was $44 million. I mean, God knows what it is today, but back in the 90s, I was keeping track, and by about the year 2000, I'd figured out there'd been about $50 billion had been spent since 1972, you know. And you look at where the money went, the one place it didn't go was to blackfellas. You know, here and there, in a few little scams, not a lot, a few blackfellas, you know, maybe 10 all over the country, managed to get their hands on piss-weak amounts of the money. But the real money, the billions, the hundreds of millions, was being grabbed by state governments, you know, Aboriginal health money, Aboriginal employment money, creating jobs for white public servants, for white administrators, for white everything, you know. And we wrote about it in the National Aboriginal Islander Health Organisation. We were challenging the way in which the Commonwealth was expending its money for all those years, you know. And it was clear, long before Pauline Hanson came along and started talking about an Aboriginal industry, we'd actually been calling it the Aboriginal gravy train, you know. But it was the same thing, all that money being spent. Hanson was no dummy in the sense that she saw there was vast amounts of money being spent for no effect. But she was wrong in her assumption that that money was going to blackfellas. You know, that's the only point where she went wrong and buggered up her argument. But it was interesting because most of the beneficiaries, the white beneficiaries of all of this money, were the ones who jumped on Pauline Hanson and said, oh, you're just a racist. You know, and that way the real debate that should have taken place got confused in all this bullshit arguments about who's a racist and who isn't. Whereas had there been a serious look at the underlying thing that she was talking about, and it, like I say, it wasn't just her who was talking about it. For two decades before that, people like me and an army of other blackfellas around Australia were pointing the finger and saying, look where all this money's going. You know, because if you look at Aboriginal health, for example, back in 1972 when Gough Whitlam started putting Commonwealth money into the Aboriginal health situation, the first budget was around $22 million. Now, $17 million of the $22 million went straight to the various state health departments, the state health bureaucracies, and were put in the hands of the people who'd actually created the problem in the first place, because it was neglect on the part of state health authorities that had led to the appalling situation of Aboriginal health all over Australia. And yet, all the Commonwealth money that suddenly, you know, suddenly there's all this Commonwealth money starting to flow, the state health mob jump in and grab that. And it was a joke, it was a running joke at one point in Western Australia, who were getting the biggest amount of money, that it was a standing joke in the West Australian Health Department. Hey, you want to drive a four-wheel drive with a two-way radio? You know, come and work in Aboriginal health. You know, you can get a four-wheel drive and you can go on long trips into the bush and, you know, spend up galore. You know, get an Esky and all this sort of stuff. Or, you know, an electric refrigerator in your four-wheel drive, no problems. You know, plenty of Aboriginal money. But at the same time, the health statistics of Aboriginal people in Western Australia was absolutely shocking. We had the highest rate of leprosy on the planet Earth in Western Australia, for crying out loud, at this time. You know, and there were clear reasons as to why Aboriginal people were dying like flies, but the people who were getting all the money weren't really interested in doing anything to solve the problem. Because what happens if you solve the problem? You know, the money stops flowing. All of the lurks and perks for the white bureaucrats, the white administrators, the missionaries, mercenaries and misfits would evaporate. So there's nobody in the Aboriginal industry who's really interested in solving the problem, because, you know, that creates another problem. What are we going to do? Where are we going to get our next paycheck from then? You know, where are we going to get our never-ending paychecks and our lurks and perks and our four-wheel drives with two-way radios?
Well, the annual funds now is $25 billion a year.
Oh, there you go.
Have things changed?
It's unbelievable, mate. If you think about it, and I've said, just I said earlier on this program, if all that money would have gone directly to the people who needed it, you know, as Chicka Dixon used to say, fund the needy, not the greedy. You know, if all that money had gone to the people in genuine need around this country, then every blackfellow in Australia would be driving a Rolls Royce. Would have no health problems because we'd be able to afford the best health care in the world. You know, we wouldn't have to worry about jobs. We'd be just, our only problem would be, our only problem would be figuring out where to invest our billions of dollars.
Yeah.
You know?
So how do we make changes?
There would be no sort of serious problem.
Is this new government, and headed up by Warren Mundine, got a chance of, are you confident that they might make some changes? Reviewing.
Let me put it this way. I don't have any fear of Abbott. I mean, a lot of people walk around saying, oh, Abbott's going to do this and Abbott's going to do that. I don't think Abbott's going to be any worse than the Labor Party was. How could anyone be any worse than the Labor Party was?
Jenny Macklin.
You know, people think that, oh, you know, Labor are the good guys and the Libs are the bad guys. What a lot of nonsense. What a simplistic political analysis. I mean, look at what Labor done to us. Labor has done more damage to Aboriginal people's interests in the last 50 years than anything that the Libs have done. And it's Abbott is a strange character, mate. I've watched him, watched his political progress from the time he was a university student. I've known him for part of that time a long time ago, and I've watched him very carefully. I knew he'd get where he is one day to where he is now, and who knows? I mean, I just don't believe that the Libs are going to be any worse than Labor were. I mean, it remains to be seen. But as a general rule, Aboriginal people have always done less worse under the Conservatives than we have under Labor. So it'll be interesting to see. In terms of Warren Mundine, well, you know, I wonder how long Warren will last. I mean, he's up against the terrible trio who are going to be jockeying with him for Abbott's ear, you know, and it'll be interesting to see who wins that fight, because I can't see someone like Noel Pearson sitting down and letting someone like Warren Mundine become the premier advisor to Tony Abbott and Aboriginal stuff. So I would expect there's going to be some sort of a shit fight between the main right-wing Aboriginal people who think that they've got Tony Abbott's ear, who think they're in good with him, and so there'll be a blue amongst them.
So while all that's happening, what do we do in communities? What do we do as a mob? I mean, what do you think can be done while these fellows are arguing and carrying on and getting Abbott's ear? What can we do? Setting our own agenda.
That's been always done, and that is try and hold the fort, try and maintain our communities with some degree of integrity and independence. I mean, you know, the real battle at the end of the day is against the creeping assimilation. You know, in just the time me and you have been alive, the assimilation project has advanced extraordinarily. And the real worry is, and you know, I gave a speech at Sydney Opera House a couple of years ago where I was only half joking when I said, well, you know, in 75 years' time, you just won't have to worry because there won't be any Aboriginal people left. They'll all be assimilated out. You'll have a lot of coconuts running around, but you won't have any Aboriginal people who sort of relate to Aboriginal values, who, you know, think in Aboriginal terms. You're going to have a bunch of Noel Pearson-type assimilated ones, and that'll be the end of the problem for the white fellas. So yes. That's what we've got to fight against, you know. That's where the real battle is, because our values, our sort of whole way of life, our whole way of thinking is being undermined and stolen from us in the same way as most of our land was undermined and stolen from us, you know.
So for the benefit of our listeners, how do people, our mob, that do want an education, they do want a job, they're strong in cultural identity or maybe even not even strong in their cultural identity. What is the message? How do people not get caught up or not become the assimilated black, but they can get a decent education, like yourself, a PhD? They can.
I would never argue that somebody shouldn't get education. In certain ways, education is the key. Education is giving yourself the weaponry to be able to survive and contend with the arguments that they want to make against you, you know. And education is, the only regret that I've got about doing my education, going to Melbourne Uni, is that I left it so late.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's crazy. Within 3 weeks of me getting my doctorate, I had a heart attack, nearly died. You know, and not only that, I'm on the verge of compulsory retirement age, so it's not much good to me in the long run. Whereas I just wish that I would have done this when I could have, which was when I, not long after I left high school, I could have done this. The experience I had going to high school and the racism I encountered there in the North Coast, New South Wales, put me off education for most of my life, which is a great pity. So I would argue with young people, even if you do suffer a couple of setbacks through racist teachers or, you know, people who don't understand, you've got to hang in there and persist and just keep on coming back till you get your educational qualification, you know, and that equips you to be able to survive, at least, you know. The better educated you are, or the better educational qualification you've got, the better chance you're going to have to earn the money to survive and look after your family and be able to be as independent as possible through the process of living.
And in doing that,
be able to express your Aboriginal values, you know.
Yes, yes. In doing that doesn't necessarily mean you're an assimilated black.
No, shouldn't I? I mean, if you're assimilated in the mind, then you're assimilated. But it's possible. I mean, to be economically independent, either as an individual or as a community of people, is really important, because it's economic independence that gives you self-determination, that gives you control over your own life, gives you control over your own affairs. If you ain't got economic independence, I mean, the ideal way as blackfellas, we should be thinking in terms of this as groups of people, as nations of people, but that's not practical. Then even on a personal level, it's important for Aboriginal people to try and maintain a level of economic independence, either as individuals or extended families or whatever. But to be able to generate your own resources and to be able to be self-sufficient is really important. That's what freedom is in this sort of society that's imposed upon us today. If you're economically independent, then you've got a level of freedom that other people who ain't economically independent ain't got, and what we've been denied and deprived of for most of our history, you know?
I, from my own observations, I'm seeing the struggle of our people trying to conform, trying to comply, living in two worlds, trying to run corporations or just a community-controlled organisation and coming unstuck. Too often we see people coming unstuck. I see it as a clash of cultures, cultural values, and even language, lack of communication, not being able to understand white system and the white system not being able to understand black values, black ways. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, here, this is part of the reason why education is important. It's important that we have people who are who have the education and knowledge and skills to be able to run major corporations and run them in a way that is for the benefit of the community rather than for the benefit of some individual manager or a managerial elite, you know, a managerial class. And this is where ideas, some of the ideas, this is why I got problems with some of the ideas of Noel Pearson. He seems to, in from my interpretation of what he writes and says, he seems to argue that that what we need is economic development, which is fine. I got no problem with that. But he argues that such economic development needs to be brought about and placed in the hands of a managerial and entrepreneurial elite. Now, this is where the real difference between what Pearson says today and what the old Black Power movement was talking about. We were talking about economic development as a means of taking communities towards economic self-sufficiency, economic independence. But we weren't talking about that sort of development or economic development or anything being in the hands of an elite, and especially not a managerial or entrepreneurial elite. You know, this is why a lot of the catch cries of the early Aboriginal organisations of the late 60s, early 70s were community control. You know, we saw the importance of creating cooperatives rather than capitalist enterprises, you know, and there's a really important difference, because when you've got a cooperative, an economic cooperative of some sort, then you're talking about values that are essentially, well, are closer to the traditional Aboriginal way of doing things, which, you know, where everybody progresses together rather than sort of one or two become better than the other sort of thing. And it's and so we've got to, you know, this is where people have got to think about the ideas of the likes of Noel Pearson and some of the stuff that's been promoted in Cape York. I mean, I don't have an argument with him on the need, as far as possible, to create some sort of economic development that gets sustainable jobs and opportunities for people in communities. But I'm not in favour of that sort of economic development that puts the profits into the hands of a select few rather than into the interests of the broader community itself, you know. So it's a complicated thing, but these are part of the ways in which I think that the blackfellas need to think through and try and figure out in terms of the way in which organisations are run. And I agree that in terms of some of the big Aboriginal organisations around the country, at times they've been run by people with no experience, and that should never have been allowed to happen. There's got to be a way in which, okay, if you need non-Aboriginal expertise in the beginning to manage the stuff until such time as you train up your Aboriginal people, which was the theory, which was supposed to be what was happening 30, 40 years ago, but somehow or other the Aboriginal people never got trained, and the white managers managed somehow or other to stay in place and to be permanently there, sort of helping out the poor little blackfellas who don't seem to be able to, you know, be trained, which is nonsense.
We often hear about good governance. You need good governance. But is good governance enough? I mean, do you need people that can smell a rat?
Who's saying the term. It depends who's saying good governance, and depends on what their definition of good governance is. Hmm. You know, it's people like people up in... I would expect that, and I might be putting words in his mouth, which I shouldn't, but I would have thought that Noel Pearson might think that good governance is governance that enables... a small elite of him and his mates to get a lot wealthier at the expense of everybody else. I may be out of line saying that, but in essence, you know, that's the logical end result of the ideas or some of the ideas and notions that he promotes.
But you can have governance structures in place, and you can be ticking the boxes for governance. But is it not more than that? Does it come down to the integrity of the individuals and the people that make up the board?
Integrity and honesty.
Yes.
You know, which aren't always the things that that accountants firms like PricewaterhouseCoopers and others would argue is good has got anything to do with good governance. But why the hell should we be fitting into their, like you said before, you know, sticking a square peg in a round hole? Aboriginal people, that's not the way Aboriginal people think, and it's not the way Aboriginal people have done things in the past. And the way in which we do things is not necessarily bad. It's only bad in the eyes of people, accountants who've got some sort of a fetish about balancing figures and things. Now, that's not saying that, you know, the way we do things ain't going to work out with balanced figures and everything, but the way in which we arrive at those balanced figures may not be the same as the PricewaterhouseCoopers mob, because PricewaterhouseCoopers accountants, white accountants type model would always ensure that, you know, that small managerial elite were the ones who were looked after first. In an Aboriginal model, it would be the community that was thought of first and looked after first before the managerial elites.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is probably a 3-hour lecture. I'd do at my uni if I thought about it properly.
All right. My guest is Gary Foley. I have a caller on the line. Sam Watson, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, very well.
Hey,
Sammy.
Mr. Foley, how are you doing, brother?
Good, brother. That was London.
London was good. Jermaine sends her love, and the book launch was great. Plenty of young students there, plenty of discussion, and sold a few copies, mate. So well done.
So we're talking, for those who don't know, we're talking about a book that I edited on the Aboriginal Embassy. It's probably the most comprehensive collection of material on the 1972 embassy that's ever been put together. And because of my heart attack, I couldn't get to London for the launch, which is where it was launched. And Sammy went in my place. Good on you, brother.
Very good.
Yeah, mate. Very good. It was all good. Look, I don't want to cut into other people's time, but I'm just wondering what your view on the future of the embassy would be, please.
You mean the embassy in Canberra?
Yeah.
That's a tough one, brother. I haven't had much to do with the embassy for 20 years or so. And I think it's an important, you know, it's the fact that it's still there is an indication that things have not got better. I heard Tony Abbott the other day somewhere saying, oh, the embassy should go because things are better now. Well, you know, things are patently obviously not better, you know, to people like me and you and, me and you two blokes, been around long enough to know that things are not only not better, they're actually a lot worse. So there's a good, strong reason for the embassy to stay there. At the end of the day, it's up to Aboriginal people who've been involved in the embassy to get their act together and talk amongst themselves and themselves decide. I don't think that anybody external to the embassy should be having any real say in what happens.
What about those, Gary?
Then I think that they've got to be involved in it.
Gary, what about those, Gary, that are saying, well, look, there's native title legislation. We're recognised traditional owners. We weren't around at the back in 72 when the embassy was established. But they.
Well, if there's any traditional owners out there who think they've gained recognition through the Native Title Act, then I'd tell them to go away and read the Native Title Act, and they might have those sort of delusions corrected. You know, that's a nonsensical argument for getting rid of the embassy. I mean, native title and even constitutional recognition that's now being mooted is, these are diversionary tactics, you know, meaningless. And it was, you know, unachievable anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, in the same way as reconciliation was something that was plucked out of thin air by Robert Tickner as a means of diverting Aboriginal people's attention from demonstrating at the bicentennial, in the same way, this constitutional change they're talking about now is another of those sort of diversionary tactics. It's just a diversionary tactic intended to get us talking about something that's completely irrelevant, completely meaningless, and won't mean anything even if it happens. You know, let's get the blackfellas arguing amongst themselves about some other silly thing and divert attention from the real issues of, land rights, sovereignty, that sort of stuff.
What are your thoughts on sovereignty? Some sort of an agreement for our mob, with our mob?
Well, it depends what people think sovereignty is. Sovereignty is something that's asserted by nations by military force. If you want to assert your sovereignty, you go and get yourself an army and assert it. Government, sovereignty is not something that governments are going to give you. It's not something that governments are going to recognise. It's a complex sort of thing, but at the end of the day, always was, always will be Aboriginal land, mate. It's our land. It's the Mabo decision of the High Court, when they found that terra nullius was no longer the justification upon which the legitimacy of all Australian institutions was built, then the High Court at that very instant ceased to have any validity, shouldn't have had any more say. What should have happened at that split second in Australian history, there should have been a United Nations peacekeeping force sent into Australia to keep the peace until such time as the question of who owned the, you know, whose sovereignty was it here, you know. Aboriginal sovereignty was back on the table the instant the terra nullius went out the window. And what happened after that, in terms of the creation of the Native Title Act and everything, has no legitimacy whatsoever. You know, the Native Title nonsense is as valid as a notion in law, well, as a notion anyway, as what terra nullius was, you know. And in the long run, if we can all survive long enough, sooner or later that'll be thrown out too, and there'll be some sort of recognition. Who knows? Who knows what might happen in the next decade or two, because we've got a different world now. I mean, the new world order means that people who aren't Americans, aren't English, are going to have the power, you know, and the power in the United Nations. And the world landscape might look a bit different in the next 20 years. When China takes over the world, things might, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Who knows? And we should be looking towards making friends with the new powerful forces in the new world. Forget about the Yanks, forget about the Poms, forget about the Europeans. They're nobodies in the world of tomorrow. Let's start making alliances with the strength of tomorrow and see what happens then. Hmm. Who knows what happens, you know? But it won't happen in my lifetime.
You might get to 80 plus. You might get to mid-80s. Let's.
Well, not the way I'm going.
Thanks, Sam, for your call. He dropped out. Something happened here where he's dropped out on me. But thanks for the call, Sam.
I want to say something for a national audience before I go.
Yes.
And I pointed out in my Facebook page yesterday. Yesterday was 107 days since I stopped smoking. I want to encourage all blackfellas in Australia to stop smoking. When I was thinking about it, I realised that virtually all of my closest friends, you know, some of the greatest Aboriginal leaders of all time, Jig Addiction, Bruce McGuinness, just about everyone I've lost in the last 30 years were to smoking-related illnesses. Mm. Now, I now know how easy it was to, well, you know, I stopped in the middle of my heart attack. But that's what's going to happen if you don't stop smoking. When you have your heart attack, you know, you may not survive like I did. You may not realise what was going on to you like I did. You may not get to hospital as quick as I did, which is the only reason I'm still here. You know, it was a question of minutes that saved my life. But I want to say to all people, all black fellas who smoke, you want to, you know, you're doing the gubs a favour by killing yourself that way. So in the same way as Yul Brynner said, I say to you, don't smoke.
But it's more than smoking, Gary. It's don't take your health for granted, isn't it, really?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know. But I thought I was...
Our diet. Look at our diet, the Western diet.
I was riding a push bike, you know, 20 k's a day from the time I turned 40. And because I was smoking and because my diet wasn't 100% as good as it should have been, I nearly died. That gave me a big shock, mate. That's, you know, it's a big wake-up call. And I know that a lot of blackfellas around Australia, not all, some, reckon that they respect me and like to listen to me. Well, if you do want to listen to me, the best message I've got for you, if you're a smoker, do yourself, do your family, do your kids a favour. Don't die in front of your kids.
Yeah.
Don't don't make your mates go to your funeral or go and watch you in the oxygen tent in hospital like I've done to a few of my mates, you know. It's not only about you, it's about us. And remember, our survival is our revenge.
Listen, that's a good one. The last couple of minutes, I want you to make a comment on what your thoughts are regarding parliamentary identified positions, similar to New Zealand.
Well,
any good to us?
I don't think it's... I wonder how much it's good it's done in New Zealand. I mean, they're just taking gestures in certain ways, and it may work a bit better in New Zealand because the Maoris have got the numerical strength that they have. I mean, they're a greater portion of society than what Aboriginal people are. And there's also the different history of the Treaty of Waitangi, which put them in a better position. And I've always been a separatist, you know, which is not a idea for all mobs in Australia, but there are some who I think could make a go of it and assert their independence and be fairly strong and live in an independent way without interference from white Australia. But, you know, there are many different situations around Australia, and each mob has to figure out in the long term what's going to be best for them. And, you know, in order to survive as mobs, that's the real battle.
Yeah.
We're going to survive the genocide project. We're going to survive the assimilation project, which is advancing today in a far speedier way than it ever has.
So cultural identity is a key element of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, brother. Look, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
No worries, Tiger. Greetings to all the mob all over Australia and all my friends and relatives out there, wherever you are.
Good on you, brother.
And I'm going well.
Yeah, well, keep on that
I'm
push bike.
Survive.
A non-smoker on a push bike, mate. You've got to live to another 20 years.
Indeed. One hopes so.
All right.
I'm going to go and get my push bike right now.
Good on you, mate. Thank you.
If you see me out there, folks, if you're in Melbourne, you see me riding on my bike, drive carefully, folks.
Talk to you later. Thank you very much.
Okay, brother.
Bye now.
See ya.
Dr. Gary Foley, historian, lecturer. Columnist with Tracker Magazine, and by the way, Tracker Magazine has just come out, so make sure you get down there to your news agent and tell them you want Tracker. You want your Tracker. It's the headlines, well, the front cover is a picture of Abbott, the new Prime Minister, and how Black Australia rejected Tony Abbott is the headlines there. A vote of no confidence in Tony Abbott, apparently. Well, you heard Chris Graham talking about the survey that he was involved in where they saw the high numbers of First Nations voters not voting for this Prime Minister for Aboriginal people. It's, as you've heard with Foley, there's a number of key issues. One is education. The education does, if we can get through that education system, we have choices and understand the system better maybe for some. But education, cultural identity, assimilation, don't let the system assimilate you. You can have a job. You can have an education and you don't necessarily need to be an assimilated black. Stay strong. Don't compromise our old people's values and our culture. I'm back tomorrow morning. Make sure you join me on Let's Talk. You can join me on your First Nation station. Have a great day.